Good evening. It is Friday, November 22nd, 2019. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are joined by a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, as always, welcome.
Glad to be here.
We're joined by a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. He is Jim Cavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with yesterday. House Democrats concluded their 72-hour impeachathon with testimony from two witnesses, Fiona Hill, a former White House advisor on Russia, and David Holmes, a counselor in the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, who reinforced the narrative that President Trump withheld military aid and a coveted White House meeting from Ukraine to sway that country to investigate his political rival. Have they been able to present, they being the Democrats, present a case to the American people that will impact how they vote in 2020? Has the needle been moved, or without a conviction in the Senate, will the Democrats have shot themselves in the foot? Caleb Maupin.
Well, the polls show that the American public isn't particularly convinced and isn't particularly interested in this entire fiasco. There's plenty of criticism of Trump, but the public is far more interested, according to polls, in defeating Trump in the election. There are quite a few people that are very, very interested in the Democratic primary and the upcoming vote. But in terms of removing Trump from office, polls show the U.S. public is opposed to it. Polls also show that people aren't that interested. It's just, this is something that means a lot to the Democratic Party's base. I think it also means a lot to certain factions within the political establishment that disapprove of maybe some of Trump's foreign policy. But in terms of the U.S. public, I mean, they just really aren't on board with this like they have been.
Jim Cavanaugh.
Yeah, you know, look, it's so obvious that people aren't interested in it. People, the Democrats aren't even talking about it on the stump, the primary people. They don't even dare raise a question about it in the debates. You look at these things and you spend hours in the weeds of Ukrainian politics. And what you're getting is, first of all, a picture of how the United States is running Ukraine and micromanaging everything about it. And you get speeches from people like Fiona Hill and Vindman about Russian aggression and how the Russians attacked Ukraine, Russia attacked Ukraine and invaded Ukraine and invaded Georgia in 2008. And this is all about, you know, this is a bunch of really lies about Russia, about American policy towards Russia. And, you know, as if the history of Russia and Ukraine started, you know, the day after the Crimea vote. And you know, everything about this is warmongering for Russia. And how we should be ashamed that Donald Trump or anybody would even for a second think about not giving these weapons to the fascist-led government in Kiev, weapons that Donald Trump, that Obama didn't want to give because he understood the problems here. This is a civil war, and you don't want to get involved in it and exacerbate it. So, you know, just watching – and anybody – how it's just – you know, there was a Canadian journalist who said something I think is quite excellent. The Democrats' monomania over Trump exactly parallels his egomania about himself. I mean, get over this fixation with let's get Donald Trump out of office right now and argue the politics and the political program that you're going to defeat him with next year.
Obviously, Jim, to that point, they didn't learn their lesson from Hillary Clinton.
Nope.
Daniel Lazar, your thoughts, sir.
I agree with Jim. I think I think it was a real neocon love fest, especially when Fiona Hill spoke. And I think this whole process completes the neocon takeover of the Democratic Party. I mean, when she sort of essentially laid down the law about Russian interference in 2016, the Democrats were all nodding in agreement. And when she said the same thing about the importance of repelling you know, Russian aggression. They all nodded. They all said yes, yes, yes. And the Republicans were essentially mum. And, of course, the press cheered Fiona Hill on. You know, so this is the way that countries talk themselves into war. I mean, the U.S. is convinced that Russia, you know, is an aggressor. It attacked it in 2016. The Democrats are forcing themselves to gear up for a really aggressive response if they take the White House in 2020. And actually, Caleb, I think Caleb is not quite correct, because the Democrats in Wednesday's debate all parroted the line that Trump is guilty of illegal behavior, as the impeachment proceeding showed. So the Democrats are really boxing themselves into a corner where they are gearing up for war against Trump and against Russia, and it's very dangerous.
Caleb.
In terms of the U.S. public, though, that would be my response, is polls continue to show people don't have the level of enthusiasm. The viewership of these impeachment hearings is much lower than James Comey's testimony. It's much lower than the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, on some level, the U.S. public just doesn't have the will to do this. The Democratic Party, you know, certainly is running with this. And I mean, I think you called it right when you called it a neocon show. They are essentially using what is supposed to be an impeachment about Trump, impeachment hearings about Donald Trump and did he break the law, and they're using it to insert, without any question or debate, all kinds of very, very controversial narratives. And we all know that there's multiple sides to every story. And they are inserting this neoconservative, anti-Russia narrative about Ukraine, about all kinds of aspects of Ukraine. I was listening to these hearings. I mean, you would think that every problem that Ukraine has had, you know, ever was caused by Russia and the Soviet Union. I mean, it was unbelievable to hear what some of these diplomats, I mean, when they talk, I mean, and no one disagrees with them. Democrat, Republican, they sit there and nod their heads. They ask them softball questions. No one dares argue with this narrative that all of Ukraine's problems are caused by Russia. The question seems to be somehow, you know, again, they're keeping this Russiagate narrative alive somehow, even though this is not even what Trump's being investigated for. He's being investigated for, you know, was he inappropriate and, you know, threatening to not give aid and the phone call with Zelensky. He's not. I mean, the Russiagate thing is dead and buried, but yet we're still talking about it. They've basically kept it going on CNN.
Well, with all of this Russia mongering, focusing on the notion that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, Hill offered a blunt warning about the 2020 campaign, saying the Kremlin has geared up to repeat their attacks and we're running out of time to stop them. And then ironically, the day after she testifies, that being today, CNN reports that a former FBI lawyer is under criminal investigation after allegedly altering a document related to a 2016 surveillance of Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. So the situation doesn't sway an independent, didn't sway the determination about the validity of the surveillance. But this does, I think, support a position that the FBI has committed wrongdoing and that there may be more to the stories that the Russiagate thing is a fraud. We'll have to see how the report comes out, but this latest FBI story sure doesn't help the cause, Jim Kavanaugh.
Well, yes. And, you know, Dan has said that a number of times, and it's true. There is this investigation coming from Dunham that might blow up the Democrats. And the Democrats are being warned, essentially. Graham put out a request today for information, and he's signaling to the Democrats, we're going to be going, you know, when it gets to the Senate, we control the witnesses and we control the process, and we're going to go after Biden and we're going to go after Burisma. So all of this is going to turn around on the Democrats when it gets into the Senate. And as things come out about this FBI changing the warrants and changing and what were the real predicates for the FISA warrants, there's a whole can of worms that's going to open up. The Democrats think they can finish this up before it's going to affect the election. It's just going to go on, and it's going to go on through the Democratic primaries unless they get it over with quickly. And the only way it's going to get over with quickly is he's acquitted in the Senate. And it's just a political disaster for the Democrats. I don't understand it. And, you know, I'll point out quickly a contradiction that nobody seems to be noticing. First of all, there was the prime directive was we have to defeat Trump at all costs. We can't really have discussions about big social issues and that are divisive and that'll divide the party, because the main prime directive in the history of the universe is to defeat Trump. Then all of a sudden, Nancy Pelosi says we got to go for impeachment. And when they ask her, but suppose this hurts you electorally, suppose this ends up not only getting Trump reelected, they asked her, suppose it hurts, it means that the Republicans take over the House. And she said, oh, that doesn't matter now. We have our constitutional duty to try to impeach Trump, even if it's going to hurt, even if it's going to help him get reelected. That's a big contradiction that was kind of unexplained here. Yesterday it was everything the Democrats have to do has to be to make sure we don't defeat Trump in 2020. Now it's even if it helps reelect Trump in 2020, we have to do this impeachment process.
Let me do this. I know, Caleb, your time is limited. And before you go, can you talk about your RT report on Big Pharma pushed a pro-opioid narrative? What's the relationship between Purdue Pharma, the American Enterprise Institute, and a psychiatrist named Sally Satel?
Well, it was an interesting report. We simply showed that the New York Times ran an article written by a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Sally Satel, and she wrote in this article some very misleading information about the danger of opioid addiction. And if you look at it, one of the main funders, or a primary funder of the American Enterprise Institute, is Purdue Pharma. And the study that she cited in order to make her point that being prescribed painkillers does not put you at risk for becoming an addict, which is simply inaccurate, it was a study carried out by consultants and employees of Purdue Pharma. So, you know, now Sally Satel said that she had no idea that Purdue Pharma had funded the American Enterprise Institute, but if you look at it, it's not the only, you know, the only place that Purdue Pharma has exercised its influence in American politics. They created something called the American Society of Pain, or the American Pain Society. They created something called the American Academy of Pain Medicine. All of that, we shouldn't be afraid to prescribe opioid pain medicine, and that the dangers of addiction were overblown and overstated. The idea was pushed, which is simply not accurate, that people that become addicted to opioids after taking them for pain were already addicted to other drugs or already had drug addiction issues, which is not very, I mean, that just doesn't match with the reality, but some studies that they carried out, were cited. And it shows that there was a big effort. And this has come out in many court cases. I mean, these court cases, these lawsuits have gone through. A lot of settlements have been paid out. But this is an ongoing thing. And Purdue Pharma is just one big corporation that fits this particular pattern that has played out. And that's what I illustrated in my report.
Caleb Maupin, thank you so much for your time. I know, again, you've got to run. And I appreciate your contribution today to the panel and look forward to having you back.
Sure. Always a pleasure.
Jim Cavanaugh and Daniel Lazar, please stay with me. And hey, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and it's Friday. It's panel time, and we had to drop Caleb Maupin, but fear not, he's been replaced with Dr. Linwood Tahee, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Linwood, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
We also have staying with us Jim Cavanaugh and Daniel Lazar. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I want to quickly just a couple other points I wanted to bring up on the impeachment process. One of these you all have already touched on, but Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said that Trump's actions were beyond even what President Nixon did in the Watergate scandal that forced him to resign. Now, I think Trump is as guilty as the day is long. But the differences that I see between then and now, that being Nixon and now, are one, the country is more partisan now. The ideological lines are much more clearly drawn, and people are viewing a lot of this through their partisan lenses. And two, the Democrats haven't presented the smoking gun case that they keep telling us that they have. And so the average person isn't glued to their TV or radio watching or listening to this. Dr. Linwood Tahid, your thoughts, sir?
Well, I think the closest to a smoking gun that the investigation has turned up, or the inquiry actually, has turned up so far was the statement from the witness in the restaurant that he overheard Trump and Sondland talking about the Bidens.
That would be David Holmes.
That would be Holmes, yeah. And you know, that testimony would be dramatic, but it wasn't really that clear that he actually understood what was going on. I mean, you have to put a lot of other things together to support his testimony. So I think, you know, they may have a smoking gun, but the idea that this is somehow unusual for a president to do is not going to stand up. I mean, I think Trump's defense in this is that basically this is what presidents do. And he's not the first one to hold up aid to a country for something that he wanted them to do. And he was really concerned about corruption. And so there is corruption with the Bidens and Burisma. The Democrats' defense on that is that this is a witch hunt or a conspiracy theory. But there is yet to be actually an investigation into the relationship between Hunter Biden and Biden and Burisma. And that investigation is something that the Democrats are not going to do. But the Republicans, when this thing goes over to the Senate, will certainly pursue that.
Daniel Lazar, it's one thing to have a circumstantial case in a court of law. It's another to have a circumstantial case in a court of public opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with Holmes' testimony is that Sondland, who was the guy on the phone with Trump, said the opposite. He said that Trump didn't mention the Bidens. He only mentioned investigations. So that's a very important point. And since Sondland was the guy on the phone, I think that that Holmes' testimony is not very strong. He's kind of knocked out of the box. So I think Trump actually fared fairly well in this last week of elections, I think, of our testimony. I think he was he sort of escaped mostly unscathed. And the fact that Sondland testified that he told him in his final phone call, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, just tell Zelensky to do the right thing, that's a very important testimony in Trump's favor.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, again, everybody's right. It's too ambiguous. It's something that nobody's really interested in. Nobody really believes, I don't think, that no president has ever asked for a political favor for himself from another head of state, okay? And, you know, again, Trump keeps doing things that get himself in more trouble than he needs to. You know, I mean, he released this transcript and he keeps tweeting out things. And, you know, if you establish this principle that we're going to now investigate every telephone conversation that a president has with another head of state and see if they're doing something to get some political benefit to them, that's just going to be outrageous and ridiculous. And you can't do it. And everybody kind of knows that. And, you know, these particular inferences and implications of what this means, it's just not going to work politically for the American public. And I don't think it's going to get certainly not going to get enough Senate Republicans voting to convict, unless they got something going on behind the scenes that we don't see, which is possible, on the basis of the fact that Trump is not a reliable warden of American imperialism, and they think they know that some Senate Republicans are going to vote on that basis. This is going nowhere.
And to that point, and quickly, and then we'll get out with this, Daniel Lazar, is it possible that when this gets to the Senate, that former National Security Advisor John Bolton flips on the president and spills the beans? Bolton's lawyer has said he's willing to testify only if a federal judge rules he can do so over White House objection.
But yeah, but I don't think Bolton has anything. Yeah, Bolton may have some interesting stories, but I really doubt that he'll come up with a smoking gun either.
Okay.
I don't believe there's any smoking gun there.
Kavanaugh?
Well, yeah, I think Bolton could say, yes, he did this, but will the people care about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And will the pressure on the political pressure on the Senate Republicans from the Trump supporters be overcome by this? And I don't think so. Although you do have the CNN and NBC wall of noise every day that, oh, blockbuster, blockbuster, this is a sure thing, it's all over, he's a criminal, he's treasonous, et cetera. But I don't think it's going to work.
And Dr. Taheed, to the wall of noise point, I have heard some people with contacts say that there are discussions within the Republican ranks that if more people start to tune into that wall of noise, and if Mitch McConnell sees that his Senate majority is in jeopardy, that he will release Republican senators to vote to convict the president.
Well, let's assume that this impeachment, the impeachment vote happens by the end of the year. It gets turned over to the Senate. The Republicans in the Senate have from January through November to figure out what their strategy is going to be. And to add to the wall of noise and to the Bolton point, if Bolton becomes an ally to Democrats, it's only because neocon warmongers will wrap them up in a bundle with Republican warmongers and vote to remove the president for someone who is more imperialistic. And to have that sell to a Democratic audience is going to be very difficult. And so the Democrats are in a quandary in terms of who they get in bed with. And if Bolton is the one, they are in trouble.
Deep, deep kimchi. Let's shift now to the shift. The U.S. says that Israeli settlements in the West Bank do not violate international law. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the reversal of decades of American policy that may doom any peace efforts. The Trump administration declared on Monday that the United States does not consider Israeli settlements in the West Bank a violation of international law, reversing 40 years of American policy and removing what has been an important barrier to annexation of Palestinian territory. Your thoughts, Daniel Azar?
Well, it's obviously outrageous, a huge step backwards. I mean, the situation in the West Bank is explosive. It's as racist as you can possibly imagine. The settlers strut around like white people in Mississippi circa 1965. And anyone who's ever been there just can sort of feel in his bones just the completely, outrageously unfair situation that exists for the Palestinians. You know, same as anybody would have felt the same, you know, in the Deep South a half a century ago. So it's a huge step backwards, I guess, but it's not going to, I mean, it's not going to work because it's just the situation there is building up to explosive levels. And I think that Israel is being torn apart in the process. And I think the Trump administration is sort of stepping into a hornet's nest.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah. Well, this is Trump once again after the Jerusalem sovereignty, after the sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And now Trump is making explicit what has actually been the implicit policy of the United States all along, which is Israel can do whatever it darn well wants, and we're not going to stop them. And Trump is now saying, we are now saying that explicitly, and we're sanctioning everything that Israel has done. It's an explosive situation. It's disgraceful. It is colonialism, and it will explode at some point in some way. You know, an interesting fact here is that if the Democrats wanted to impeach Trump for something, you know, and go after corruption, Kushner and Trump's family actually have investments in the West Bank and in these settlements. But you're not going to hear them go after that.
Dr. Linwood Taheed.
Yeah, it's everything that Jim and Daniel have said, and it's not unexpected given the rise of fascism around the world, the fascist movements, of course, being given comfort by the position of the avowed position of the Trump administration, which, as was said, has always been the position of the U.S. government, but now it's now in the open and no one has to hide. And so the Israelis, the Israeli government now feels that they have support and protection for anything that they want to do to get rid of the Palestinian issue by getting rid of Palestinians.
Daniel Lazar, is it a coincidence that this statement was made on Monday, as you still have Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu trying to figure out who's going to be able to form a government? And then we have now that Netanyahu is indicted on charges of fraud, bribery, and breach of trust.
Well, I think it was basically a coincidence, yes. I mean, I think Trump was happy to intervene in behalf of his friend Netanyahu, but I think the timing was related to the indictment or to the ongoing paralysis, political paralysis in Israel.
Well, let me get you to clarify that. I don't think that the timing of the U.S. statement was tied to the bribery charge. I don't think that, but I think that Donald Trump was trying to throw Netanyahu a lifeline that was hopefully going to help him form a government. You don't think that that was the case?
No. I think that's quite plausible. I think that's very likely true. I have no evidence, but yes, Netanyahu and Trump are close collaborators. And Trump certainly is doing whatever he can to help Netanyahu out. And their politics are very, very close. So, yes, I think that makes a great deal of sense.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You know, this is, but to repeat, this is another nail in the coffin of the honest brokership of the United States and the two-state solution. And good riddance to both of them.
Linwood Taheed.
I think what's not coincidental here is the similarity of the probe going against Netanyahu and the inquiry against Trump. I mean, both of them have been engaged in what we could describe as crimes against humanity. In fact, definitely are, putting babies in cages, involving innocent children. While they did that, there was no indictment, no inquiry. But when they became involved in political issues, bribery or investigation of the Bidens, then now all of a sudden it's time to indict them or impeach them. And so you can do all kinds of atrocities and never come to an impeachment or an indictment. But when you start to mess around in the political sphere and engage in dirty tricks among the elite, now it's time to get rid of you.
Daniel, to Linwood's point, Netanyahu's been involved in these tactics and these actions for quite a long time. And he calls his indictment on corruption charges an attempted coup, which to me is laughable. And we're going to get to this in a few more minutes when we look at what's happened in Bolivia with Evo Morales and what's happened in Venezuela with Nicolas Maduro. Those are some real coups. I just find it interesting that for as long as Netanyahu has been prime minister, and for all the years that I've been hearing that his politics have always been dirty, I just wonder why now.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think this indictment has been brewing for years and years. This investigation has been going on for at least 5 years. So finally, they finally have sprung the trap. But Netanyahu is obviously, you know, copying Trump's rhetoric. I mean, Trump has called the impeachment investigation an attempted coup.
Right.
And so so Netanyahu is now echoing Trump. I mean, I always regarded Netanyahu as Trump's teacher, but maybe that relationship has changed, and maybe Trump is now Netanyahu's teacher. But I think what's very important to keep in mind is that just as the U.S. is deeply divided and deeply unstable, I mean, Israel is even more so. I mean, Gantz, when he's trying to put a government together, was dependent on the 10 to 12 votes of the Arab joint bloc, I think it's called, joint list. And Netanyahu called that an existential threat. In other words, he used an outrightly racist line of attack against Gantz, who, by the way, is a right-of-center politician, an ex-military man who's hardly less, you know, hardly better than Netanyahu, only by a hair, really. So, and then Netanyahu is himself beholden to the ultra-Orthodox, who, believe it or not, are largely anti-Zionist, who refuse to join the Israeli military and often, you know, spit on Israeli soldiers when they're home on leave and they venture into the ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods of Jerusalem. So the country is really polarized and deeply unstable, and they can't get a coherent majority. This will be the third election in, what, a year and a half, I think it is? And so it's heading for a period of instability, just as the U.S. is. The U.S. is also increasingly unstable, increasingly polarized, with no way of getting a coherent majority, it seems.
And Jim Kavanaugh, to Daniel's point about the unrest, the political internal unrest, polls are showing that now with the indictment against Netanyahu, that the support for him internally is really shifting away.
Yeah, he's got now some challenge from within the Likud party that's really going to threaten him. He's got a young guy, I forget his name, who is saying he's going to primary him. And Netanyahu really wants to hang on to the prime ministership because that's the only thing that gives him immunity. And it could give him immunity as long as he's in that. Any other circumstance, he has no immunity from prosecution, even as another minister. And so he's hanging on to that desperately. But, you know, this, of course, these splits in Israel and these fights in Israel, we shouldn't convince ourselves or fool ourselves that they're going to make any life any better for the Palestinians. In terms of the Palestinian situation, the settlements, the colonialism, the Gantz party is not going to be any better than that than the Netanyahu party, or anybody who comes up and challenges Netanyahu in the Likud party is not going to be any better than Netanyahu with that. So, you know, from a point of view of that, it doesn't make much difference. But it is we are watching someone, I think, who's had a great run and been a very ruthless guy getting a comeuppance.
And final point, Linwood, to Kavanaugh's point, this to me sounds a lot like an internal family squabble. You know, I can fight with my sister, but man, if you try to fight with my sister, you really got to fight on your hands.
I would agree with that. This is a fight among the oligarchs, among the aristocracy. And I think there's an old African proverb, you know, when the elephants fight,
the grass struggles, right?
And so while the aristocracy is struggling over who has bribed who in a system where bribery is rampant, the population, the regular people are suffering with climate change and health care and unemployment and other kinds of things, because those issues are not important to the aristocracy. And so we have to wait. The rest of us have to wait while they figure out who's going to lead from either side for the next regime.
Gentlemen, appreciate that analysis. Please stay with me, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we're so fortunate to have with us Dr. Linwood Tahid, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We're also blessed to have with us political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. More on the other side. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we are joined by Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Tahid. We're joined by political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Gentlemen, thank you so much, as always, for staying with me. Bolivia is descending into a full-blown far-right military dictatorship. The Bolivian military forced President Evo Morales to step down, which is the classic definition of a coup, And now the country, particularly the indigenous population in the country, is caught in a spiral of horrors as the far-right regime of terror consolidates its rule. What is going on or continuing to go on in Bolivia, and why aren't we hearing anything about it in major mainstream media, Daniel Azar?
Well, what's going on is that the one regime in Bolivian history which gave the indigenous population a fair shake has gone down in flames, and now the old oligarchy, the old ruling class, ruling elite, has years of stored up anger, which is it is now venting, and things could get really scary there. I mean, remember the whole Andean indigenous population was virtually enslaved for centuries, and they've only gotten a taste of freedom in the last 30 or 40 years, and got a bit more under Evo Morales, and so now they're finding that taken away from them. They're finding them facing a vengeful racist government, which wants to grab it all back, and they are terrified of being thrust back into some kind of serfdom. And that seems to be what the future has if current trends continue.
Dr. Linwood Tahid, going down in flames, and Evo Morales was able to improve healthcare. He was able to improve literacy. There was a growing middle class in Bolivia under Evo Morales. And it really, this is not being trite, but I don't say this to sound trite, but the very same things were going on in Venezuela. The quality of life for the average citizen in Venezuela was improving in Venezuela, just as there were elements of improvement of quality of life in Bolivia. And the United States steps in and undermines it.
Not a new thing. You well know that,
right?
You know, Morales and the Venezuelan leadership sought to nationalize resources of the country, but also to use the revenue from the nationalization to improve the lives of ordinary people, the poor. And, of course, then you have a rise of the middle class. This is something that cannot be tolerated by corporate leaders who are in Venezuela and Bolivia are directed by U.S. Corporate leaders and who are in control of U.S. foreign policy. And so the obviously attempted coup in Venezuela to put Guaido in charge did not work. It was clumsy, but I think that lesson has led to a more successful way of using the Organization for American States as the instrument to remove Morales and to give justification for that removal. And so we have a completed coup in Bolivia. We have a slow motion coup going on in Venezuela, which may very well end up with the same outcome.
Jim Kavanaugh, to Linwood's point, nationalizing resources to improve the quality of life for the impoverished in the country and talking about the historic pattern, that's the same thing that the United States did to Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran back in 1953 when he nationalize the oil and take it away from, I think it was Royal Dutch Shell and British Petroleum.
Yes. Yeah, the question that's at stake here is always, who controls the social wealth of society? And you have a small elite in any capitalist country. You have a relatively small portion of the population that does that. But in these Latin American countries, these were tiny white elites that were lording it over indigenous and mestizo populations that were really in states of near serfdom, as Dan said. And when you had movements like the Chavista movement and the Morales movement, they actually took control of a portion of that with social wealth and redirected it into the hands of to improve the lives of ordinary people and the indigenous people. And as Dan says, the oligarchy was not willing to accept that and is furious about it. And this phony business of the elections. I mean, no matter what happened in the election, Morales got more votes. The movement towards socialism has 2/3 of the seats in the Senate. Now you have a fascist and religiously fundamentalist coup, which is saying we're going to arrest Morales, which is saying we're not going to allow him to run. We're going to kick the movement for socialism. All of those people have to get out of the Senate. So this is totally anti-democratic, and it's about restoring the total control of the oligarchy of the social wealth of society and their social control as the superiors over the indigenous people.
And Daniel Lazar, it's totally anti-democratic, but the Democrats in the United States, a good bit of them, are behind this, are supporting this. Elizabeth Warren says she's down with what's going on in Bolivia. Nancy Pelosi comes out and supports the move in Venezuela, which I think, and I keep saying this because I think people truly need to understand this, that the distinctions between the two major parties in this country are not nearly as distinctive as people want to make them out to be, especially when it comes to foreign policy.
I totally agree, and I think Elizabeth Warren's statement is especially important. I mean, she completely lines up behind Trump's policy, and it's amazing. There's no democratic debate. There's no difference of opinion. The two parties are really closely aligned on these questions. The dissent is minimal, and that's what we saw in the impeachment hearings when Fiona Hill, a classic neocon, was railing against Russia. And everybody was either staying silent or nodding their heads in agreement. We are facing a two-party, a duopoly, an imperialist duopoly, which is stands shoulder to shoulder against the masses in countries like Venezuela and Bolivia.
And Linwood, the only one on the Democratic side that is taking any what I would consider to be sensible position here is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders comes out and says very clearly, this is wrong. He comes out very clearly and says, yes, I support Israel's right to exist, but the Palestinians must be treated fairly. And I even heard him say, treated as human beings.
Exactly. And he came out directly and said that what happened in Bolivia was a coup. And so, yeah, we find certainly the Bernie Sanders being consistent in his policy and his positions. And it should be no surprise that the corporate Democrats and Republicans, since they have the same donors, are obligated to take the same positions. But it's more of a problem for Democrats, because Democrats are pretending to be for democracy.
There you go.
And so they have a conundrum. How do they balance the left and the center in their party in order to get enough votes to defeat the Republicans, who are all in corporatism all the time? And, this is a struggle. It's also an internal family struggle within the Democratic Party, although it's not a party over which oligarch is going to rule. It's over whether or not we have true democracy going forward, or we have a Republican light version with the Democratic Party as it goes forward.
And Jim Kavanaugh, the balancing act that Linwood just talked about is much easier for the Democrats to do when corporate mainstream media is not educating the American public about the atrocities that are being committed in Bolivia, that are being committed in Brazil, that are being committed in Venezuela with American tax dollars and in the name of the American people.
Well, yeah, this is the induced stupidity historical stupidity amnesia of the American public via the major media, which are the major means of historical and political education in the country. And they really promote lies and fantasies and delusions. And I got to say, yeah, Bernie has been good on Bolivia, but he wasn't good on Venezuela. And the strongest voice in the Democratic Party today about imperialism, although I don't think she said anything about Bolivia,
is Lindsay.
Tulsi Gabbard.
Tulsi Gabbard, that's what I meant.
Tulsi Gabbard. And she gets insulted and absolutely excoriated for this in ways that would be horrifying if it were another woman. I mean, they write articles about how the fact that she's wearing white pantsuits and something to do with her being part of a cult and all of this. And they let Stephen Schmidt, you know, from MSNBC, bring Stephen Schmidt on to attack her and insult her. And, you know, you're being dishonest. And why did you meet President Assad? You know, well, there are pictures of Nancy Pelosi meeting President Assad in 2003. But, you know, this is all she really is getting. She's off the reservation, so to speak. You know, she's the one who's the outlier and is going and is being rejected and insulted and made anathema for her slightly anti-imperialist views.
Daniel, when at the Democratic debate, when Senator Kamala Harris tried to attack Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, if you looked at the split shot, the two shot that they had, once Tulsi got into her rhythm, Kamala's face dropped dramatically, and I think she was really sorry that she opened that can of worms.
I think Kamala Harris is a nightmare, a real nightmare. She's unbelievable. She really is. She really is a Hillary Clinton stand-in up there. No, she's dreadful. And Gabbard, you know, Gabbard is, you know, kind of a little bit wacky, but she is the only one really sticking out forcefully on these issues. And she's being very brave. She really is. And she is taking a lot of abuse. And that New York Times attack on her white pantsuit, that was just amazing. I mean, how nasty and petty can they get? The answer is, like, they'll get a lot nastier and pettier before this whole thing is finished.
There we go. That's an answer. That's an answer to a question we really don't want to find out. Final story here for the day is, and I'll start with you, Daniel Lazar. Sweden drops Julian Assange rape investigation. Prosecutor says that the country's not going to proceed with the investigation into the WikiLeaks founder. Tell us, because I know you've been one of those really on top of this. What's going on now with Julian Assange in Bowsmore Prison?
Well, it's just really outrageous. I mean, it's such an outrage. It's the mind reels. I mean, this whole rape charge was so dubious to begin with. What happened in Sweden is that a certain wing of the Social Democratic Party, which is a center-left party, pushed through a law, which is really kind of an unworkable law on dealing with rape or quasi-rape. It's very hard to explain. It's very complicated. But essentially, it has resulted in a grave injustice. Assange, you know, may have been guilty of insensitive behavior. He may have been guilty of boorishness, maybe even male chauvinism. But he was not guilty of a crime by any reasonable standard. But he was essentially facing prosecution, facing the real threat of extradition to the United States, and therefore he had no choice but to run for cover, into the Ecuadorian embassy. And now the man is in a maximum security prison in Britain. His health is rapidly declining. There's a real health emergency. And before this whole process is finished, he will very likely, well, depending on who wins the upcoming election in Britain, but very possibly, if it's the Tories, he will very possibly be extradited to the United States to stand trial for espionage and will be sent away for the rest of his life. I mean, it's one of the great outrages of our day.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, well, it's got to be clear. There were never any criminal charges brought against Julian Assange from Sweden. Never any charges. There was a 9-year preliminary investigation. He was asked to come back to Sweden to be questioned in a preliminary investigation that they kept open for 9 years in order to keep this idea that of a charge of rape might someday be posed against him, and that were hanging over his head. They never had the evidence for it. They were never going to get the evidence for it. And he wanted, and everybody wanted, the case to be, and the prosecutor had to, you know, finally, even the Swedish courts had to say, either put up or shut up with this. So that was, but, you know, it was Sweden who paved the path for everything that's happened to Julian Assange. Now they're washing their hands of it because They never could have charged him. They were never going to charge him. Now he's stuck in the, now that the British have him and that he's going to be extradited to the United States, barring some labor victory, and even barring not necessarily that, you know, the Swedes are washing their hands of it. But it's kind of a disgrace what Sweden did. This is a journalist being going to go to jail for life for journalism, for telling the truth about American war crimes.
You know, Linwood, as I think about this and think about all the furor and uproar over Donald Trump's calls with President Zelensky, I'd like to hear some of the calls between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson as it relates to Julian Assange. I'd like to hear some of the phone calls between Donald Trump and the leadership in Sweden as it relates to Julian Assange. I don't think the pressure would be any less on what they're trying to do to Assange than the pressure that Trump tried to apply to Zelensky.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's absolutely outrageous that the so-called progressives have been willing to back away from Julian Assange and from WikiLeaks when the most significant, at least in my opinion, thing that WikiLeaks was able to accomplish was the publication of the Edward Snowden papers and to get those out into publication. Julian Assange is a hero for having done that, and now progressives over some lame charge are wanting to back off from that. It's an attack on not only progressive journalism, but of course the mainstream media would like things to continue on as they are. And so Julian Assange, who has been showing them up as a true democratic journalist, has got to go.
Daniel, is my point about the language and I'd love to hear the phone calls, as I said, do you agree with that? And to Linwood's point, progressives backing away from Assange, the New York Times ran his stories. The New York Times used his information. MSNBC ran his stories, used his information, and now they've totally washed their hands of him.
Yes. I mean, first of all, I completely agree with you regarding the telephone conversations, the things that no one really cares what Trump said to Johnson regarding Assange, because that doesn't fit into the Democratic Party playbook. The other thing, which I think is very important, is that WikiLeaks is a prime victim of Russiagate. I mean, Mueller said that WikiLeaks acted as a willing partner of the Russians to subvert American democracy. And I don't think it's true. I think that the Mueller report doesn't, that part doesn't make sense. I don't believe that the Russians fed those emails to WikiLeaks. I believe that WikiLeaks got them from a non-state actor, as Assange has said. And I think that's an example of the incredible damage that this whole Russiagate fiasco has done. It's an example of how the Democratic Party is just as much a force for authoritarianism as the Republican Party is.
Let me ask you, gentlemen, really quickly. We have just about 3 minutes left. So if my math is right, that's a minute per person. Jim Kavanaugh, what are you looking forward to news-wise next week?
Oh, you always spring this on us. Yeah, I think probably nothing's going to happen in the impeachment situation. And, you know, the Israeli situation is not the Netanyahu thing is not going to have much effect in the United States. I'm looking for what's going to happen in Bolivia. I think the situation in Bolivia is developing in a way, and there are going to be fights. There are fights. There are people being killed. The question is going to be whether the popular forces are going to be able to fight back sufficiently. In order to do that, since the people were not armed and popular militias were not mobilized, they're going to have to get sectors of the police and the army to turn over to their side. And I think it's going to be very difficult to do. And I'm afraid we're going to see them defeated. But that's what I looked at as probably one of the main stories in the world today.
Dr. Linwood Taheed, what are you looking towards in terms of, or what should people pay attention to as we move into next week?
Well, I think as these impeachment inquiry hearings wrap up, they're scheduled, I suppose, if they continue to go in closed session with the Intelligence Committee, I expect the Trump administration to do a full-blown counterattack on witnesses, on their credibility, and to really be willing to reveal that Trump has done nothing that other presidents haven't done, which of course means that whatever the Obama administration, the President Obama were involved in around these issues are going to become more of their talking points. So I expect that the Bidens and the Obamas are going to be prominent in the news from the Trump administration going forward.
Daniel Lazar, what are you looking forward towards next week?
Whatever I say, I'll be wrong. But I'm still keeping my eye on the Persian Gulf, where things get ever more volatile by the day. The Saudi regime is in absolute crisis. The Iranian regime is in deep crisis as well. And so, and of course, and Israel continues to launch raids into Syria. So that is just a ticking time bomb waiting to go off. I'm surprised it hasn't gone off already. Whether the explosion will happen next week, I have no idea. But I am confident that it's going to be turned more and more volatile with each passing day.
Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, and journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Gentlemen, the three of you, as always, thank you so much for your time and your contribution and your commitment to the Critical Hour. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.